Old Charlie's lot, figuratively and literally. Most of the time now, it's just a steep, unvisited place on the backside of our farm. But for 1 week of the year, for reasons unrelated to the goat as far as we know, it's the pot of gold at the end of our rainbow. What grows there sells for upward of $20 a pound in city markets, the most prized delicacy that ever comes to our table. The mountainsides of our farm stand thickly wooded with poplar, beech, and oak. 2 generations ago, they were clear pastures, grazed by livestock or plowed for crops. This used to be a tobacco farm. It astonishes us when our neighbors look at our tall woods and say, "That's where we grew our corn. Our tobacco patch was on top for the better sun." Such steep hillsides were worked with mules and a lot of hand labor. A tractor would roll like a boulder, which is exactly why so much of the farmland around here has now grown up into medium-sized stands of trees. The deciduous eastern woodlands of North America can bear human alteration with a surprising grace. Barring the devastations of mining or the soil disaster of clear-cut logging, this terrain can often recover its wildness within the span of a human lifetime. Farming a hillside with mules had its own kind of grace, I am sure, but it's mostly a bygone option. The scope of farming in southern Appalachia has now retreated to those parts of the terrain that are tractor-friendly, which is to say, the small pieces of relatively flat bottomland that lie between the steep slopes. Given that restriction, only one crop fit the bill here for the past half century, and that was tobacco. Virtually no other legal commodity commands such a high price per acre that farmers could stay in business with such small arable fields. That, plus the right climate, made Kentucky and southwestern Virginia the world's supplier of burley tobacco. That plant works well here for cultural reasons also. It's the most labor-intensive commodity crop still grown in the United States, traditionally cultivated by an extended family or cooperative communities. Delicate tobacco seedlings have to be started in sheltered beds, then set by hand into the field and kept weed-free. Once mature, the whole plant is cut, speared with a sharp stick, and the entire crop painstakingly hung to dry in voluminous, high-roofed, well-ventilated barns. Once the fragile leaves are air-cured to dark brown, they must be stripped by hand from the stalk, baled, and taken to the auction house. On the flat, wide farms of Iowa, one person with a tractor can grow enough corn to feed more than 100 people. But in the tucked-away valleys of Appalachia, it takes many hands to make just one living, and only if they work at growing a high-priced product. The same small acreage planted in corn would hardly bring in enough income to pay the property tax. For this reason, while the small family farm has transformed elsewhere, it has survived as a way of life in the Burley Belt. Tobacco's economy makes an indelible imprint on the look of a place, the capacious architecture of its barns, the small size of its farms, and on how a county behaves, inducing people to know and depend on one another. It makes for the kind of place where, when you walk across the stage at high school graduation, every person in the audience knows your name and how much work you've been known to do in a day. Tobacco even sets the date of graduation, since the end and beginning of the school year must accommodate spring setting time and fall cutting. This was the context of my childhood. I grew up in a tobacco county. Nobody in my family smoked except for my grandmother, who had one cigarette per afternoon, whether she needed it or not, until the day in her 9th decade when she undertook to quit. But we knew what tobacco meant to our lives. It paid our school teachers and blacktopped our roads. It was the sweet scent of the barn loft where I hid out and read books on summer afternoons. It was the brown powder that clung to our jeans after an afternoon of playing in old outbuildings. It was the reason my first date had to end early on a Friday night. He had to get up early on Saturday to work the tobacco. For my classmates who went to college, it was tobacco that sent them. Me too, since my family could not have stayed solvent without other family economies that relied on tobacco. From that society, I sallied out into a world where, to my surprise, farmer was widely presumed synonymous with hee-haw, and tobacco was the new smallpox. I remember standing in someone's kitchen once at a college party, one of those intensely conversational gatherings of the utterly enlightened, listening while everyone present agreed on the obvious truth about tobacco. It should be eliminated from this planet and all others. I blurted out, foolishly, "But what about the tobacco farmers?" You'd have thought I'd spoken up for child porn. Somebody asked, "Why should I care about tobacco farmers?" I'm still struggling to answer that. Yes, I do know people who've died wishing they'd never seen a cigarette. Yes, it's a plant that causes cancer after a long line of people, post-farmer, have specifically altered and abused it. And yes, it takes chemicals to keep the blue mold off the crop. And it sends people to college. It makes house payments, buys shoes, and pays doctor bills. It allows people to live with their families and shake hands with their neighbors in one of the greenest, kindest places in all this world. Tobacco is slowly going extinct as a U.S. crop, and that is probably a sign of good civic sense. But it's also a cultural death when all those who grew it must pack up, go find an apartment somewhere, and work in a factory. What is family farming worth? Most tobacco farmers wish they could grow something else. As of now, most will have to. Federal price supports, which have safeguarded the tobacco livelihood since the Depression, officially ended in 2005. Extension services and agriculture schools throughout the region have anticipated that deadline for more than 20 years, hoping to come up with a high-value crop to replace tobacco. No clear winner has yet emerged. When I was in high school, the family of one of my best friends tried growing bell peppers, the latest big idea of the era. They lost the entire year's income when the promised markets failed to materialize. I still get a knot in my stomach, remembering the day their field of beautiful peppers, representing months of the family's labor and their year's livelihood, had to be plowed back into the dirt, in the end worth more as compost than as anything else. If people out in the world were irate about the human damage of tobacco, why wouldn't they care enough and pay enough to cover the costs of growing vegetables? I can date from that moment my awareness of how badly our food production system is deranged and how direly it is stacked against the farmer. The search for a good substitute crop is still on, but now that the modest price supports have ended, farmers in tobacco country have only a year or two more to figure out how to stay on their land. Vegetables are a high-value crop, especially if they're organic, but only in areas that have decent markets for them and a good infrastructure for delivering perishable goods to these markets. The world's most beautiful tomato, if it can't get into a shopper's basket in less than 5 days, is worth exactly nothing. Markets and infrastructure depend on consumers who will at least occasionally choose locally grown foods and pay more than rock-bottom prices. In my county, two of the best tobacco transition experiments to date are organic vegetables and sustainable lumber. A program in our area offers farmers expert advice on creating management plans for the wooded hillsides that typically occupy so much of the acreage of local farms. Mature trees can be harvested carefully from these woodlots in a way that leaves the forests healthy and sustainably productive. The logs are milled into lumber, kiln-dried, and sold to regional buyers seeking alternatives to rainforest teak or clear-cut redwood. When we needed new oak flooring in our farmhouse, we were able to purchase it from a friend's woodlot nearby. No farmer earns a whole livelihood from this, but the family farm has a tradition of cobbling together solvency from many crops. Experimental programs like these, though new and small, are notable for the way they turn a certain economic paradigm on its head. U.S. political debate insistently poses economic success and environmental health as enemies permanently at odds. Loggers or owls, people or green spaces, the presumed antagonism between man and nature is deeply rooted in our politics, culture, bedtime stories, Red Riding Hood's grandma or the wolf, and maybe even our genes. But farming at its best optimizes both economic and environmental health at the same time. A strategy that maximizes either one at the cost of the other is a fair working definition of bad farming. The recent popularity of agriculture that damages soil fertility still does not change the truth. What every farmer's family needs is sustainability, the capacity to coax productiveness out of the same plot of ground year after year. Successful partnerships between people and their habitats were once the hallmark of a healthy culture. After a profoundly land-altering hiatus, the idea may be regaining its former shine.
Is Bigger Really Better? By Stephen Hobb. Which are more economically productive, small family farms or big industrial farms? Most people assume they know the answer and make a corollary assumption that small farmers are basically asking to go bankrupt. They're inefficient even though their operations are probably more environmentally responsible, sustainable, diverse, and better connected to their communities than the big farms are. But isn't it really just about the profits? If so, small farms win on that score too, hands down. According to the USDA records from the 1990s, farms less than 4 acres in size had an average net income of $1,400 per acre. The per-acre profit declines steadily as farm size grows to less than $40 an acre for farms above 1,000 acres. Smaller farms maximize productivity in three ways: by using each square foot of land more intensively, by growing a more diverse selection of products suitable to local food preferences, and by selling more directly to consumers, reaping more of the net earnings. Small farm profits are more likely to be sustained over time, too, since these farmers tend to be better stewards of the land, using fewer chemical inputs, causing less soil erosion, maintaining more wildlife habitat. If smaller is economically better, why are the little guys going out of business? Aside from their being more labor-intensive, marketing is the main problem. Supermarkets prefer not to bother with boxes of vegetables if they can buy truckloads. Small operators have to be both grower and marketer, selling their products one bushel at a time. They're doing everything right. They just need customers. Food preference surveys show that a majority of food shoppers are willing to pay more for food grown locally on small family farms. The next step, following up that preference with real buying habits, could make or break the American tradition of farming. For more information, visit nffc.net.
The people of Southern Appalachia have a long folk tradition of using our woodlands creatively and knowing them intimately. The most caricatured livelihood, of course, is the moonshine still, hidden deep in the hollow. But that is not so much about the woodlands as the farms. Whiskey was once the most practical way to store, transport, and add value to the small corn crops that were grown here. These hills have other secrets. One of them is a small, feisty cousin of garlic known as the ramp. Appalachian mothers used to regard these little bulbs as a precious spring tonic, one that schoolboys took willingly because it rendered them so odoriferous they'd likely get barred from the schoolhouse for several days. For reasons not entirely clear to the outsider, ramps are still prized by those who know where to find them in the earliest days of spring. The emergence of ramps elicits joyous, stinky ramp festivals throughout the region. Ginseng, another Appalachian botanical curiosity, is hunted and dug up for its roots, which sell for enormous prices to consumers on the other side of the world. Sang hunters know where to look and tend to keep their secrets. So do molly mooch hunters. And if you think you've never heard of such, you just don't know the code. A molly mooch is a morel. The mushroom genus Morchella contains some of the most highly prized of all edible wild fungi. Morels fruit in the spring, and just to keep you on your toes regarding the wild mushroom situation, they contain toxic hemolysins that destroy red blood cells, chemicals that are rendered harmless during cooking. Just don't eat them raw. Their close relatives, the Gyromitra, are pure poison, but the edible morels look different enough from anything else that they're safe to collect, even for novice mushroomers like me. Their distinctive tall caps are cupped and wrinkled in a giraffish pattern unique to their kind. Here in the eastern woodlands, we have the black, common, tulip, and white morels, and one unfortunate little cousin called, I am so sorry, the dog pecker. All are edible except for the last one. They're similar enough in ecology and fruiting time that we've sometimes gathered many types on the same day from the same wooded areas. I've heard them called molly mooch, sponge mushrooms, haystacks, dryland fish, and snakeheads. What everyone agrees on is that they're delicious. Wild mushrooms are among the few foods North Americans still eat that must be hunted and gathered. Some fungi are farmed, but exotics like the morel defy all attempts at domestication. Maybe that's part of what we love about them. Alice Waters writes, "With their woodsy, earthy, complex flavors and aromas, and their rich primeval colors and forms, wild mushrooms bring to our kitchens a reminder that all the places we inhabit were once wildernesses." They're also incredibly hard to find, very good at looking exactly like a little pile of curled, dead brown leaves on the forest floor. In my early days of molly mooching, I could stand with my boots touching one without spotting it until it was pointed out to me. They're both particular and mysterious about where they grow. In old apple orchards, some people vow, while others insist it's only around the roots of tulip poplars or dying elms. Whatever the secret, the molly mooches do know it, because they tend to show up in the same spot year after year. On our farm, we could have walked the woods for the rest of our lives without finding one, because they don't grow near our roads or trails, they've never shown up in our old apple orchard, and they're shy of all other places we normally frequent. Where they do grow is in Old Charlie's lot. We know that only because our friends who grew up on this farm showed us where to look. This is the kind of knowledge that gets lost if people have to leave their land. Farmers aren't just picturesque technicians. They are memory banks, human symbionts with their ground. My family is now charged with keeping the secret history of a goat, a place, and a mushroom. Just as our local food pledge had pushed us toward the farmer's market on the previous Saturday, it pushed us out the back door on the following cold, rainy Monday. Morels emerge here on the first warm day after a good soaking mid-April rain. It's easy to get preoccupied with life and miss that window, or to coast past it on the lazy comfort of a full larder. This April, our larder was notably empty. Partly, I suppose, for just this reason, to force us to pay attention to things like the morels. Stephen came home from his teaching duties, donned jeans and boots, and headed up toward Old Charlie's lot with a mesh bag in hand. Mushroom ethics mandate the mesh collecting bag so the spores can scatter as you carry home your loot. No loot was carried that day. We really knew it was still too cold. We'd had snow the previous day. But we were more than usually motivated, so on Tuesday, in only slightly nicer weather, Stephen headed out again. I was mending a broken leg that spring and could not yet navigate the steep, slick mountainside, so I was consigned to the wifely role of waiting for Man the Hunter to return. After the first hour, I moved on to the wifely custom of worrying he'd fallen into a sinkhole. But no, he eventually returned from the woods, empty-handed but intact. He was just being thorough. On Wednesday, he went out again and came back through the kitchen door with a conspicuous air of conquest. Triumphantly, he held up his mesh bag, a few dozen fawn-colored, earthy, perfect morels. It wasn't a huge catch, but it was big enough. By the weekend, there would be more, enough to share with our neighbors. I grinned and went to the refrigerator. A little while earlier, I'd gone up to the garden and returned with my own prize, lying across my forearm like two dozen long-stemmed roses, our most spectacular asparagus harvest ever. We put our mollies in a bowl of salt water to soak briefly prior to cooking. I'm not sure why, but our mushroom-hunting friends say to do this with morels, and I am not one to argue with wild mushroomers who claim the distinction of being still alive. I sat down at the kitchen table with Deborah Madison's gorgeous cookbook, Local Flavors, which works from the premise that any week of the year can render up, from very near your home, the best meal of your life. Deborah's word is good. We cooked up her bread pudding with asparagus and wild mushrooms for a fantastic Wednesday supper, seduced by the fragrance even before we took it out of the oven. Had I been worried that cutting the industrial umbilicus would leave us to starve? Give me this deprivation any old day of the week. On Saturday, the weather was still cold and windy. I pulled my seed potatoes out of storage to check on them. Not a pretty picture. Sick to death of the paper bags in which they'd been stored since last fall, they were sending long, white, exploratory sprouts into the darkness of the bottom drawer of the refrigerator. We decided, for their sakes, that the wind had dried the ground enough for us to till the potato patch with the tractor. A few weeks ago we'd tried that too early, and the too wet ground behind the tractor rolled over in long curls of thick, unworkable clay clods. Today the soil was still a bit too clumpy to be called perfect, but perfect is not the currency of farming. I followed behind the tiller, breaking up clods with a hefty Italian grape hoe, the single piece of equipment I rely on most for physical fitness and sometimes therapy. We hoed out three deep rows, each about 70 feet long, in which to drop our seed potatoes. If that seems like a lot for one family, it's not. We do give some away and save some for next year's seed, but mostly we eat them. New potatoes all summer, fingerlings in the fall, big indigo blues and Yukon gold bakers all winter. In my view, homeland security derives from having enough potatoes. On the same long day, we dropped peas into furrows, seeded carrots, and set out more of the broccoli we'd planted in succession since mid-March. My baby onion plants, 200 of them, were ready, so I tucked the string bean-sized seedlings into rows along the cold, damp edge of the upper field. Stockton reds, yellow sweets, torpedoes, and a small, flat Italian favorite called Boretana Cipollini. I was anticipating our family's needs, knowing I would not be purchasing vegetables from the grocery store next winter. Two onions per week seemed reasonable. Onion plants can take a light frost, so they don't have to wait until the full safety of late spring. Their extreme sensitivity is to day length. Short-day onions, like Vidalias, planted in autumn in the deep south, are triggered to fatten into bulbs when day length reaches about 10 hours in May or so. By contrast, long-day onions are planted in spring in the north as early as the ground thaws, so they'll have enough growth under their belts to make decent-sized bulbs when triggered to do so by the 15-hour days of a northern latitude high summer. If you didn't realize onion farmers had to be this scientific about what varieties they plant, that's just the start. They're also required by law to live within a 17-county area centered on Vidalia, Georgia, in order to sell you a Vidalia onion, or in the Walla Walla, Washington region to print Walla Walla sweets on the bag. French wine growers are not the only farmers who can market the subtleties of soil and climate, the things that translate into the regionally specific flavor they call terroir. The flavor of an onion, like that of a wine grape, is influenced by climate, soil chemistry, even soil microbes. It's surely true of other vegetables, or would be, if we knew enough of our own local flavors to recognize them. The earliest plantings are onions, potatoes, peas, and the coal crops. Broccoli, cauliflower, kale, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts are all the same genus and species. All these do well in cool weather and don't mind a few weeks of frost or even snow on their heads. Broccoli buds will start to pop up above their leaves in the last cool days of May. In the same weather, snap peas twine up their trellises lightning fast and set their pods. Along with rosy new potatoes and green onions pulled early from bed, these will be the first garden proceeds, with asparagus, cold hardy spinach, and other salad greens. The garden bereft don't have to live without these pleasures. In most of the country, farmers' markets get going in April or early May. Especially in the Northeast, market gardeners are also savvy about stretching the season with cold frames, so these treasures can fill their stalls very early in limited quantities that will go to the early risers. If you picture the imaginary vegetannual, you'll see these are the earliest tendrils of annual growth, leaves, shoots, and buds, filled out with early production coaxed from overwintered roots. Grocery store habituated shoppers may only have eyes for the 4th of July fireworks kind of garden bounty, big blousy tomatoes, eggplants, and summer squash. But many weeks before that big bang, subtle pleasures begin pushing up through the chill. Come and gone again if you weren't ready. I'd offer the same advice I include in my directions for finding our little town. Don't blink. You'll miss us.
Getting It While You Can, by Camille. When our family first started our local food project, I was daunted. How ironic, I thought, while most parents are harping on their kids to eat more fruits and veggies, my sister and I are being told to give up the juicy pleasure of a fresh peach or pear all winter. I tried to picture how I would get through the months when there are no apples, no plums, and the strawberries of spring seem light years away. This may sound dramatic, but fruit is my favorite food. I was forced to get creative. The first step, shopping, is actually easier. When you peruse the farmer's market for fresh produce, the options are clear. You don't miss what's not there either, like Skittles placed at a third grader's eye level in the checkout. No wailing kids or annoying tabloids. Oh my God, is Brangelina really over? Just wonderful, fresh things to eat. As the seasons change, different fruits and vegetables come and go, so as a shopper you learn a get-it-while-you-can mentality. The first strawberries showed up at our farmer's market in late spring on a day when I'd stopped in alone on my way home from a morning class. When I saw giant boxes of strawberries piled on the tailgate of a farmer's truck, I didn't waste 10 seconds asking myself the questions I would mull over in a conventional grocery. Do I really want berries today? Are these overpriced? Are they going to mold the minute I get them home? I power walked past other meandering shoppers and bought a bucket load. I drove home daydreaming about the creations I could cook up with my loot. The key to consuming enough produce and reaping maximum nutritional benefits is planning meals around whatever you have. This presents opportunities to get inventive in the kitchen and try new things, like stuffed zucchini. How many spinach dishes can you have in 1 week without getting sick of it? When working with fresh ingredients, the answer is a lot. The variety comes automatically, as you eat loads of leafy greens in April, but find them petering out soon, with broccoli becoming the dark green vegetable of choice. You won't have time to get too tired of any one food, and your nutrient needs will be met. There's no need to measure out every tedious 1/4 cup of raisins and 1/2 cup of chopped peppers. Two things that are impossible to get tired of are asparagus and morels, because neither one stays around long enough. If you have them on the same day in April, you'll forget all about peaches and can make a wonderful asparagus and morel bread pudding from Local Flavors by Deborah Madison, which is also on our website.
Chapter 6. The Birds and the Bees. One of my favorite short stories is Eudora Welty's Why I Live at the P.O. It's a dead-on comic satire of a certain spirit of family life, and it feeds my private fantasy that I too might someday take up residence in the U.S.P.O. If other people don't share this ambition, they just haven't been blessed as I have. Latest in the line of my estimable male associates was Postmistress Anne, manager of all things postal in our little town. These things taking place within a building about the size of a 2-car garage. When we moved, I rented one of their largest boxes for my writer mail, apologizing in advance for the load of stuff I'd be causing them to handle. Anne and her colleagues insisted the pleasure was all theirs. "We're lucky we still have a P.O. in our little town," they explained. "The government keeps track of what's moving through, and if the number is too low, they'll close the branch." "I'll bet you get lots of interesting things in the mail," they surmised. I thought to myself, "You have no idea." So I turned over 3 pieces of ID to prove I was citizen enough to rent a postal box in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and since then I have wondered if they've ever had second thoughts. Such surprising gifts come to me through the U.S. mail. A canjo rhymes with banjo, with a body made from a Mountain Dew can, handcrafted by a man who felt I needed to have one. So did, he felt, President Carter. Class projects? Paintings of imaginary people? More books than probably burned in the Alexandria Library? Anne sounded unfazed on the morning she called to say, "You better come get this one. It's making a pretty good racket." Maybe in places like Hollywood, California, postal clerks would be uneasy about weighing packages and selling stamps, while 28 baby chickens peeped loudly into their right ear and 4 crates of angry insects buzzed in their left. Not here. They all just grinned when Lily and I came in. The insects weren't ours, but Anne invited Lily to check them out anyway. "Come on back behind the counter, hon. Take a look at these bees. They've got honey dripping out already." "Bees? Ho-hum, just an ordinary day at our P.O. I adjusted my notion of myself as a special needs postal customer. Lily bent over the bee cages, peering at the trembling masses of worker bees humming against the wire mesh sides of the boxes. The sticky substance dripping out was actually sugar water, sent along to sustain the bees through their journey. Down below the buzzing clots of worker bees sat the queen bees with their enormous hind ends, each carefully encapsulated in her own special chamber. These big-bootied ladies were replacement queens ordered by local beekeepers from a bee supply company to jump-start hives whose previous queens were dead or otherwise inadequate. But Lily quickly turned to the box with her name on it, a small cardboard mailing crate with dime-sized holes on all sides and 28 loud voices inside, the noise density quotient of 1 kindergarten packed into a shoebox. Lily picked it up and started crooning like a new mother. This was the beginning of a flock she'd been planning for many months and will be tending, I presume, until we see her off to college. Because we knew the chicks were coming this morning, I had allowed her to stay home from school to wait for the call. She wasn't sure the principal would consider this an excused absence. I assured her it was a responsibility large enough to justify a few hours of missed class. I hadn't even known we'd be having lessons in the birds and the bees. Once she'd brought them home, taken her 28 chicks out of that tiny box, and started each one on its path to a new life under her care, Lily was ready to get back to third grade. When we signed her in at the principal's office, the secretary needed a reason for Lily's tardiness. Lily threw back her shoulders and announced, "I had to start my own chicken business this morning." The secretary said without blinking, "Oh, okay, farming," and entered the code for "excused agriculture." Just another day at our elementary school, where education comes in many boxes. I already knew what we'd be in for when we got the baby chicks home. I'd been through the same drill a week earlier with my own poultry project, 15 baby turkeys. I'd lifted each one out of the box and they hit the ground running, ready to explore the newspaper-lined crate I'd set up in the garage. Right away they set about pecking at every newsprint comma and period they could find. These peeps were hungry, which meant they were born 2 days earlier. Poultry hatchlings don't need to eat or drink for the first 48 hours of life, as they are born with a margin of safety called the yolk sac. The yolk of the egg absorbed into the chick's belly just before hatching. This adaptation comes in handy for birds like chickens and turkeys that have to get up and walk right away, following mom around to look for something edible. Other baby birds live in a nest for the first weeks, waiting for a parent to bring takeout. Newborn poultry can safely be put in a box right after hatching and shipped any place they'll reach in 2 days. Some animal rights groups have tried to make an issue of it, but mail-order chicks from reputable hatcheries have virtually a 100% survival rate. Until I opened up the box and let in the sunlight, my poultry babies must have presumed they'd spent their last 2 days of incubation in an upgraded community egg. Now they were out, with yolk sac tummies crying, "Time's up!" I scattered a handful of feed around the bottom of their crate. Some of the less gifted pushed the food aside so they could keep pecking at the attractive newsprint dots. Oh well, we don't grow them for their brains. I filled a shallow water container and showed them how to drink, which they aren't born knowing how to do. They are born, in fact, knowing a good deal of the nothing a turkey brain will ever really grasp, but at this stage their witlessness was lovable. I picked up each one and dipped its tiny beak into the water. Soon they caught on, and it was the rage, this water drinking, as all the poults tried dipping and stretching like yodelers, now urgently pecking at any shiny thing, including my wristwatch. From time to time, one of the babies would be overtaken by the urge for a power nap. Staggering like a drunk under the warm glow of the brooder lamp, it would shut its eyes and keel over, feet and tiny winglets sprawled out flat. More siblings keeled onto the pile, while others climbed over the fuzzy tumble in a frantic race to nowhere. It's a good thing they don't stay this adorable forever. I'd raised turkeys before, with the cuteness factor being a huge worry at the start. When they imprinted on me as Mama and rushed happily to greet me whenever I appeared, I just felt that much more like Cruella de Vil. Inevitably, though, all adorable toddlers turn into something else. These babies would lose their fluff to a stiff adult plumage, and by Thanksgiving they'd just be beasts. In the case of the Toms, testosterone-driven beasts that swagger and charge blindly at anything that might be a live female turkey, i.e. anything that moves. As time took its course, turkey nature itself would nudge us toward the task of moving them from barnyard to the deep freeze. This one little shoebox of fluff, plus grain, grass, and thyme, would add up to some 200 pounds of our year's food supply. I can't claim I felt emotionally neutral as I took these creatures in my hands, my fingers registering downy softness and a vulnerable heartbeat. I felt maternal, while at the same time looking straight down the pipe toward the purpose of this enterprise. These babies were not pets. I know this is a controversial point, but in our family we'd decided if we meant to eat anything, meat included, we'd be more responsible tenants of our food chain if we could participate in the steps that bring it to the table. We already knew a lot of dying went into our living. The animals, the plants in our garden, the beetles we pull off our bean vines and crunch underfoot, the weeds we rip from the potato hills. Plants have the karmic advantage of creating their own food out of pure air and sunlight, whereas we animals, lacking green chlorophyll in our skin, must eat some formerly living things every single day. You can leave the killing to others and pretend it never happened, or you can look it in the eye and know it. I would never presume to make that call for anyone else, but for ourselves, we'd settled on a strategy of giving our food a good life until it was good on the table. Our turkeys would be pampered as children and then allowed a freedom on open pasture that's unknown to conventionally raised poultry. Thanksgiving was still far away, and some of these birds would survive the holidays if all went according to plan. Our goal was to establish a breeding flock. These were some special turkeys. Of the 400 million turkeys Americans consume each year, more than 99% of them are a single breed, the broad-breasted white, a quick-fattening monster bred specifically for the industrial-scale setting. These are the big lugs so famously dumb they can drown by looking up at the rain. Friends of mine swear they have seen this happen. If a broad-breasted white should escape slaughter, it likely wouldn't live to be a year old. They get so heavy, their legs collapse. In mature form, they're incapable of flying, foraging, or mating. That's right, reproduction. Genes that make turkeys behave like animals are useless to a creature packed wing to wing with thousands of others, and might cause it to get uppity or suicidal, so those genes have been bred out of the pool. Docile lethargy works better and helps them pack on the pounds. To some extent, this trend holds for all animals bred for confinement. For turkeys, the scheme that gave them an extremely breast-heavy body and ultra-rapid growth has also left them with a combination of deformity and idiocy that renders them unable to have turkey sex. Poor turkeys. So, how do we get more of them? Well, you might ask. The sperm must be artificially extracted from live male turkeys by a person, a professional turkey sperm wrangler, if you will, and artificially introduced to the hens, and that is all I'm going to say about that. If you think they send the toms off to a men's room with little paper cups and Playhen magazine, that's not how it goes. I will add only this. If you are the sort of parent who threatens your teenagers with a future of unsavory jobs when they ditch school, here's one more career you might want to add to the list. When our family considered raising turkeys ourselves, we knew we weren't going to go there. I was intrigued by what I knew of older breeds, especially after Slow Food USA launched a campaign to reacquaint American palates with the flavors of heritage turkeys. I wondered if the pale, grain-fattened turkeys I'd always bought at the supermarket were counterparts to the insipid vegetable formerly known as tomato. All the special qualities of heirloom vegetables are found in heirloom breeds of domestic animals, too. Superior disease resistance, legendary flavors, and scarcity as modern breeds take over the market. Hundreds of old-time varieties of hoofstock and poultry, it turns out, are on the brink of extinction. The American Livestock Breeds Conservancy keeps track of rare varieties of turkeys, chickens, ducks, sheep, goats, pigs, and cattle that were well known to farmers a century ago, but whose numbers have declined to insignificance in the modern market. In addition to broader genetic diversity and disease resistance, heritage breeds tend to retain more of their wild ancestors' sense about foraging, predator avoidance, and reproduction, traits that suit them for life in the pasture and barnyard rather than a crowded, windowless metal house. Many heritage breeds are adapted to specific climates. Above all, they're superior in the arena for which these creatures exist in the first place. As food. Heritage livestock favorites are as colorfully named as heirloom vegetables. You can have your Tennessee fainting goats, your Florida cracker cattle, your Jersey giant chickens, your Gloucester old spots hogs. Among draft animals, let us not forget the American mammoth jackass. The American Livestock Breeds Conservancy publishes directories of these animals and their whereabouts, allowing member farmers to communicate and exchange bloodlines. We decided to join the small club of people who are maintaining breeding flocks of heritage turkeys, birds whose endearing traits include the capacity to do their own breeding all by themselves. 8 rare heritage turkey breeds still exist: Jersey Buff, Black Spanish, Beltsville Small White, Standard Bronze, Narragansett, Royal Palm, Midget White, and Bourbon Red. We picked the last one. They are handsome and famously tasty, but for me it was also a matter of rooting for the home team. This breed comes from Bourbon County, Kentucky, a stone's throw from where I grew up. I imagine my paternal grandmother playing in the yard of the farm where these birds were originally bred, an actual possibility. Fewer than 2,000 Bourbon Reds now remain in breeding flocks. It struck me as a patriotic calling that I should help spare this American breed from extinction. Slow Food has employed the paradox of saving rare breeds by getting more people to eat them, and that's exactly what happened in its 2003 Ark of Taste Turkey Project. So many people signed up in the spring for heirloom Thanksgiving turkeys instead of the standard butterball, an unprecedented number of U.S. farmers were called upon to raise them. The demand has continued, so we jumped on that wagon, hoping to have our rare birds and eat them too. Lily's chickens, however, were a different story, her own. The day of their promised arrival had been circled on her calendar for many months. April 23rd, my baby's due. Some parents would worry about a daughter taking on maternal responsibility so early in life, but Lily was already experienced. She started keeping her first small laying flock as a first grader back in Tucson, where the coop had to be fortified against coyotes and bobcats. The part of our move to Virginia that Lily most dreaded, in fact, was saying goodbye to her girls. The friends who adopted them are kind enough to keep us posted on their health, welfare, and egg production. We prepared her in advance for the move by promising she could start all over again once we got to the farm. It would be a better place for chickens, with abundant green pasture for a real free-range flock, not just a handful of penned layers. You could even sell some of the eggs, I'd added casually. Say no more. She was off to her room to do some calculations. Lily is the sole member of our family with gifts in the entrepreneurial direction. Soon she was back with a notebook under her arm. It's okay to move, she said. I'll have an egg business. A few days later, she brought up the subject again, wanting to be reassured that our Virginia hens would just be for eggs, not for meat. Lily knew what farming was about, and while she'd had no problem eating our early turkey experiments, chickens held a different place in her emotional landscape. How can I convey her fondness for chickens? Other little girls have ballerinas or Barbie posters on their bedroom walls. My daughter has a calendar titled The Fairest Fowl. One of the earliest lessons in poultry husbandry we had to teach her was why we don't kiss chickens on the mouth. On the sad day one of her hens died, she wept loudly for an entire afternoon. I made the mistake of pointing out that it was just a chicken. You don't understand, Mama, she said, red-eyed. I love my chickens as much as I love you. Well, shut me up. She realized she'd hurt my feelings because she crept out of her room an hour later to revise the evaluation. I didn't really mean that, Mama, she sniffled. I'm sorry. If I love my chicken 6, I love you 7. Oh, good. I'm not asking who's a 10. So I knew in our discussions of poultry commerce, I needed to be reassuring. They'll be your chickens, I told her. You're the boss. What you sell is your decision. As weeks passed and her future on the farm began to take shape in her mind, Lily asked if she'd also be able to have a horse. Her interest in equines surpasses the standard little girl passion of collecting plastic ones with purple manes and tail. She'd lobbied for riding lessons before she could ride a bike. I'd long assumed a horse was on our horizon. I just hoped it could wait until Lily was tall enough to saddle it herself. In the time-honored tradition of parents, I stalled. "With your egg business, you can raise money for a horse yourself," I told her. "I'll even match your funds. We'll get a horse when you have half the money to buy one." When I was a kid, I would have accepted these incalculable vagaries without a second thought, understanding that maybe a horse was out there for me, but I'd just have to wait and see. The entrepreneurial gene apparently skips a generation. Lily got out her notebook and started asking questions. "How much does a horse cost?" "Oh, it depends," I hedged. "Just a regular mare or a gelding," she insisted. "When it comes to mares and geldings, she knows the score. I'd recently overheard her explaining this to some of her friends. A stallion is a boy that's really fierce and bossy," she told them. "But they can give him an operation that makes him gentle and nice and helpful. You know, like our daddies." Okay, then, this girl knew what she was looking for in horse flesh. "What does an animal like that cost?" she inquired. "Oh, about $1,000, I said, wildly overestimating, pretty sure this huge number would end the conversation. Her eyes grew round. "Yep," I said, "you'll have to earn half, $500. She eyed me for a minute. "How much can I sell a dozen eggs for?" "Nice brown organic eggs, probably $2.50 a dozen. But remember, you have to pay for feed. Your profit might be about $1 a dozen." She disappeared into her room with the notebook. She was only a second grader then, as yet unacquainted with long division. I could only assume she was counting off dollar bills on the calendar to get to 500. In a while, she popped out with another question. "How much can you sell chicken meat for?" "Oh," I said, trying to strike a morally neutral tone in my role as financial advisor. "Organic chicken sells for a good bit, maybe $3 a pound. A good-sized roasting bird might net you $10 after you subtract your feed costs." She vanished again for a very long time. I could almost hear the spiritual wrestling match, poultry versus equines, fur and feathers flying. Many hours later, at dinner, she announced, "Eggs and meat. We'll only kill the mean ones." I know I'm not the first mother to make an idle promise I'd come to regret. My mother-in-law has told me that Stephen, at age 7, dashed through her kitchen and shouted on the way through, "Mom, if I win a monkey in a contest, can I keep it?" "Oh, sure, honey," Joanne said, stirring the pasta. She had 7 children and, I can only imagine, learned to tune out a lot of noise. But Stephen won the monkey. And yes, they kept it. In my case, what I'd posed as a stalling tactic turned out to be a powerful nudge, moving Lily from the state of loving something as much as her mother, or 6/7 as much, to a less sentimental position, to put it mildly. I watched with interest as she processed and stuck to her choices. I really had no idea where this would end. Chicks must be started no later than April if they're to start laying before cold weather. We moved to the farm in June, too late. From friends, we acquired a few mature hens to keep us in eggs and satisfy Lily's minimum daily requirement of chicken love. But the farm fresh egg business had to wait. Finally, toward the end of our first winter here, we'd gotten out the hatchery catalog and curled up on the couch to talk about a spring poultry order. Lily shivered with excitement as we discussed the pros and cons of countless different varieties. As seed catalogs are to me, so are the hatchery catalogs for my daughter. Better than emeralds and diamonds, these Rocks, Wyandottes, and Orpingtons. She turned the pages in a trance. "First of all, some Araucanas," she decided. "Because they lay pretty green eggs, my customers will like those." I agreed, impressed with her instincts for customer service. And for the main laying flock, I want about 10 hens, she said. We'll keep one of the roosters so we can have chicks the next spring. She read listings for the heavy breeds, studying which ones were strong winter layers, which were good mothers. Some breeds have motherhood entirely bred out of them and won't deign to sit on their own eggs. She settled on a distinguished red and black breed called Partridge Rocks. We ordered 16 of these, straight run, unsexed, of which about half would grow up to be females. Lily knows you can't have too many roosters in a flock. She had mentioned we would keep one of the males, implying the rest would be dispatched. I didn't comment, but it seemed we were now about 7 roosters closer to a horse. I hoped they would all be very, very mean. She paused over a section of the catalog titled Broilers, Roasters, and Fryers. Look at these, she said, showing me a picture of an athletic-looking fowl, all breast and drumstick. Compact bodies and broad, deep breasts, she read aloud. These super meat qualities have made the dark Cornish a truly gourmet item. I asked her, you're sure you want to raise meat birds, too? Only if you want to, honey. I was starting to crumble. You'll get your horse someday, no matter what. It's okay, she said. I won't name them. I'll have my old pet hens to love. Of course, I said. Pets are pets. Food is food. Out on the near horizon, Lily's future horse pawed the ground and whinnied.
The Price of Life by Stephen Hoppe. Industrial animal food production has one goal, to convert creatures into meat. These intensively managed factory farms are called concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, sometimes called CAFOs. The animals are chosen for rapid growth, ability to withstand confinement, some literally don't have room to turn around, and resistance to the pathogens that grow in these conditions. Advocates say it's an efficient way to produce cheap, good-quality meat for consumers. Opponents raise 3 basic complaints. First, the treatment of animals. CAFOs house them as tightly as possible, where they never see grass or sunlight. If you can envision 1,000 chickens in your bathroom, in cages stacked to the ceiling, you're honestly getting the picture. Actually, a 6-foot-by-8-foot room could house 1,152. A second complaint is pollution. So many animals in a small space put huge volumes of excrement into that small space, creating obvious waste storage and water quality problems. CAFO animals in the United States produce about 6 times the volume of fecal matter of all humans on our planet. Animals on pasture, by contrast, enrich the soil. A third issue is health. Confined animals are physically stressed and are routinely given antibiotics in their feed to ward off disease. Nearly 3/4 of all antibiotics in the United States are used in CAFOs. Even so, the Consumers Union reported that over 70% of supermarket chickens harbored Campylobacter and or Salmonella bacteria, the antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria that grow in these conditions are a significant new threat to humans. Currently, 98% of chickens in the United States are produced by large corporations. If you have an opportunity to buy some of that other 2%, a truly free-range chicken from a local farmer, it will cost a little more. So what's the going price these days for compassion, clean water, and the public health?
Eating My Sister's Chickens by Camille. During my first year of college, one of my frequent conversations went like this. Camille, you're a vegetarian, right? Well, no. No? You really seem like the type. Well, I only eat free-range meat. Free who? I guess I do seem like the type. Personal health and the environment are important to me, and my vocational path even hints at vegetarianism. I teach yoga and may study nutrition in graduate school. The meat-eating question is one I've considered from a lot of angles, but that's not easy to explain in 30 seconds. A lunch line is probably not the best place to do it either. For one thing, all meat is not created equal. Cows and chickens that spent their lives in feedlots, fattening up on foods they did not evolve to eat, plus antibiotics, produce different meat than their counterparts that lived outdoors in fresh air, eating grass. That's one nutritional consideration to bear in mind while weighing the pros and cons of vegetarianism. There are others, too. Vegetarians and vegans should consider taking iron supplements because the amount of this nutrient found in plant sources is minuscule compared with the amount found in meat. Of course, eating plenty of iron-containing dark leafy greens, legumes, and whole grains is a good plan. Along with a host of other essential nutrients, they do offer a good bit of iron, but in some cases it may not be enough to keep the body producing hemoglobin. Vitamin B12 is also tricky. In its natural form, it's found only in animal products. There are traces of it in fermented soy and seaweed, but the Vegetarian Society warns that the form of B12 in plant sources is likely unavailable to human digestion. This means that vegans, people who eat no meat, dairy, or eggs, need to rely on supplements or foods fortified with B12 to prevent this dangerous deficiency. Vegan diets also tend to be skimpy in the calcium department, so supplements there can be helpful as well. Humans are naturally adapted to an omnivorous diet. We have canine teeth for tearing meat and plenty of enzymes in our guts to digest the proteins and fats found in animals. Ancestral societies in every part of the world have historically relied on some animal products for sustenance. Even the ancient Hindu populations of India were not complete vegetarians, though they did not know this. Traditional harvesting techniques always left a substantial amount of insect parts, mostly termite larvae and eggs, in their grain supply. When vegan Hindu populations began moving to England, where food sanitation regulations are stricter, they began to suffer from a high incidence of anemia. Just a tiny amount of meat, even bug parts, in the diet makes a big difference. Of course, abstaining from meat for relatively short periods for spiritual reasons is a practice common to many societies. During these times, traditionally, we're meant to be less active and more contemplative, reducing our need for the nutrients supplied by animal products. Generally speaking, people who are not strict vegetarians will find more options in their local food scene. Pasture-based meat and eggs are produced nearly everywhere in the country, unlike soybean curd and other products that may anchor a vegan diet. Chicken, lamb, and other meats from small farms are available throughout the year. And while animal fats, even for meat eaters, are considered nutrition ogres, they are actually much healthier than the hydrogenated oils that replace them in many processed foods. Trans fat, a laboratory creation, has